were on a tight budget did not affect their impulse buying. So what is this telling us? Until very recently in our evolutionary history, food was hard to come by, and when you spotted it, you'd better eat it right away. The brains we all have are still wired this way. If we wait until later, the reward may be gone. It seems to be the case that seeing or smelling food primes our brains for immediate reward thinking that leaks over into other types of behavior. The study didn't say it directly, but it's plausible that "go get that cookie now" triggers "go get that sweater now," even when you don't realize it. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Orem, with help from Peter Todd in Psychological and Brain Sciences. For a Moment of Science, I'm Don Glass.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Carle Foundation's Echo Building, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:41 in sports news. After avoiding public comment through weeks of speculation about his football future, Brett Favre is speaking for himself. He wants to play but does not feel welcome in Green Bay, so he's asking to be released. Favre's first substantial comments on his latest retirement decision reversal come in an interview with Fox News' Greta Van Susteren, scheduled to air at 9 p.m. Central Time tonight. The Washington Redskins have agreed to terms with six-round draft pick Colt Brennan. The Heisman Trophy finalist threw for 4,343 yards and 38 touchdowns with 17 interceptions last season, leading Hawaii to a 12-1 record and an appearance in the Sugar Bowl. Javelin thrower Bro Greer has made the U.S. track and field team for the Beijing Olympics. The eight-time national champion did not qualify at the recent trials, but USA Track and Field decided to place him on the team. Chicago and St. Louis fans won't get their baseball fix today. The teams are on their midsummer break for tomorrow night's All-Star game at Yankee Stadium. Italy's Leonardo Piapoli won today's 10th stage of the Tour de France, which featured two punishing climbs in the Pyrenees Mountains. Cadel Evans of Australia grabbed the overall lead. That's a look at sports. Well, now NPR's Andrea De Leon is going to take us to the eastern coast of the United States, where rugged coves and weathered clapboard houses provide a perfect setting for murder mysteries.
Sarah Graves' novels, all dozen of them, take place here in Eastport, Maine, an island connected to the mainland by a long causeway. Sarah Graves first traveled that causeway over a decade ago. Back then, she went by her given name of Mary Squibb. She was a commercial writer ready to ditch Manhattan. The first Eastport mystery was in her head, all ready to write before she moved to town.
I have no idea how I expected that to happen, but I just expected that it would happen, and then we moved here, and it did. It was fate.
But like most islands, Eastport is tightly knit, its bonds made tighter by hard work and difficult weather. Then one day this writer arrives with her husband from New York. People noticed.
My very dear friends lived across the street from her, so we watched her from day one.
Mary Pottle owns a local real estate agency.
Oh, must have been something exciting over there going on. We couldn't see in the windows. New people in the neighborhood.
Someone showing up in a strange car with out-of-state plates? It sounds like something borrowed from the beginning of one of Graves' own mysteries.
The light dawned suddenly. My old book, a sudden death. And now this stranger arriving without warning.
In the books, such a stranger would inevitably wind up entangled with Graves' reluctant sleuth, Jacobia Tiptree, Jake to her friends. Graves and her character have a lot in common. Both moved to Eastport to escape the fast life in New York, and both are fixing up old Eastport houses. Jake would prefer to spend her time glazing windows or taking a sledgehammer to the ancient upstairs commode, hence the name of the series, Home Repair is Homicide, But it wouldn't be a mystery book if someone didn't turn up dead, and quickly. And Sarah Graves wouldn't be a mystery writer if she couldn't spot means, motive, and opportunity as she drives around town.
Now we are going out to the end of Water Street, to the end of what's called Dog Island, to overlook Passamaquoddy Bay.
There's a beckoning glimpse of the Atlantic, dotted with fur-covered islands, and a view to the shoreline of New Brunswick, Canada. In any other part of the country, this kind of coastline would be buzzing with jet skis and other pleasure craft. But Graves says, not so fast.
You're completely at the mercy of the ocean if you just put one foot wrong and it catches you. It looks so pretty and so romantic. And in fact, it's just absolutely deadly. You can live about 15 minutes if you fall in. Not because you will drown, but because your body will just slow down and stop from the cold.
And as a writer who occasionally needs to kill somebody...
Works great. Absolutely.
Jake Tiptree herself almost succumbs to the icy water when she gets into a skiff with a con man named Rickert in this scene from the book Nailbiter.
Rickert swung the oar. This time the flat blade connected with my shoulder the way a bat hits a ball, lifting me and carrying me over the rail. The last thing I saw was his face watching impassively as I splashed down. Then came the sudden roar of the outboard as he motored away, leaving me in the icy water, kicking and flailing, drowning.
To read the books, Eastport seems to be a pretty dangerous place, and just like in the books, there's a big police station right on Main Street in the center of town. Anybody there? No answer. The only cop on duty is later spotted flying by Bayside Mobile, blue lights flashing. Bill Wentworth pauses at the gas pump to note the action.
The highlight of our day, some poor bugger gets a speeding ticket. Not too much goes on here.
Wentworth can't remember the last time there was a real murder in Eastport. Someone recalls a shooting that happened back in the 60s. There's a little breaking and entering from time to time. But Eastport is a place where the customers have their own key to the local breakfast joint, and they open it up to make their own coffee every morning. The town has more than its share of empty storefronts, but business seems brisk at one of Sarah Graves' favorite shops.
And here we are at Wadsworth's Hardware Store.
Wadsworth's exists in both the real Eastport and the fictional Eastport. Both Graves and her character, Jake Tiptree, spend a lot of time here.
But I have always liked this stuff, little scrapers and little blades, razor. Of course I like little blades. Mystery writers all like little blades. Little foam paint brushes and drop cloths and... I don't even know what some of this stuff is, and I want it.
Wadsworth's even sells the Home Repair is Homicide series. The books are displayed along with the wrenches and saws in the front window. Cashier Winnie Higgins says locals love to read about their town.
If you live here in Eastport, you could say, oh, that's the city manager she's talking about. I mean, I'm just using that as an example. Because this is a small town, I don't want to get in any trouble.
Graves insists that, with two well-known exceptions, all of her characters are fictional. But nobody believes her. What they do believe is that Sarah Graves' books and the occasional tourists they bring are good for Eastport. The books feel cozy, just like the town. When Jake Tiptree isn't solving crimes, she's fretting over whether she has enough guest towels for a lady's tea, or who will help her dislodge the cast-iron bathtub she's gotten wedged in the upstairs landing.
I did once say in Jake's voice that in Eastport, when you need help, people will help you. You don't always have to be thinking about that to know that it's true, and that frees you up to count your punch cups if you need to.
The Eastport Sarah Graves ladles up for her readers is picturesque, but not picture perfect. A lot like the Eastport you find when you drive down that long causeway to the island, give or take a few dead bodies. Andrea De Leon, NPR News.
It was like a scene out of an old Western. Ladies in cowboy hats and big formal dresses, and men in shirts and ties riding buggies and carts behind a team of horses. But this was not a scene from an old Western. In fact, it's a scene that takes place every year in Western Illinois. Julie Root takes us on a ride to the 5th annual Bushnell Horse Show.
Old-fashioned horse show division. Back behind me, the two-seat buggy be getting hugged.
The crowd was entertained by music, the announcer on the loudspeaker, and of course, the main attraction, the horses. Gary Gunther of Smithfield brought Norwegian Fjord horses to the show in the single cart and team classes. Gunther says the Norwegian Fjord horse is known as the Viking horse.
Well, the Vikings rode them, but they're a medium-sized draft, or some of them call draft ponies. Our horses are different. They have the black dorsal stripe down the mane, the stripes on the legs. That's their prehistoric markings.
Gunther says a lot goes into getting the horses ready for a show. The horses have to be worked and desensitized to things such as dogs and cars. Gunther says to do this, he drives his horses up and down the streets in Marietta. Before taking the horses out into the show ring, Gunther puts a harness on them to hook them up to a buggy.
You put the shafts and the shaft loops, and in the back it has tugs with chains on it that we hook up to the cart, so that pulls them. They understand that this is a work day and what they have to do, and so we put the cart on them and hook them all up, and then I get in the cart and away we go.
Gunther says many factors can impact a horse's performance, such as the temperature or the crowd's reaction. He says when the horses are in the show ring, the judge is looking for how they trot, walk, and take commands from the rider. The Norwegian Fjord was one of many breeds at the event. Down on the other side of the show ring, the bigger breed of horses could be found. Krista Grange of Del Mar, Iowa, was there to show Percheron horses.
It's like the Budweiser Clydesdales. Everybody knows them, except we don't just walk through parades. We actually show and compete.
Grange says she has been showing all her life. Grange and her parents come to the Bushnell Show because it prepares the horses for some of the bigger shows, such as state fairs. Grange says they travel around to about 8 shows throughout the summer.
It's a passion. It's in my blood, so I wouldn't miss it for the world. I have a regular job, but I've scheduled my vacation where I'm going to make all the horse shows this summer.
Grange was wearing a long red formal dress and a red ribbon in her hair to complement the red bows tied into the Percheron's hair.
That's just the proper attire to dress up a little bit. Don't go in jeans and a t-shirt and tennis shoes, but that's just tradition, I guess.
Craig Hammersmith from Defiance, Ohio, also dressed up his horses. Hammersmith's Belgians all wore red, white, and blue ribbons in their manes. Hammersmith says dressing up the horse is simply tradition and something everyone does.
It shows off their neck, and you know, just it adds to the overall look of the hitch.
Hammersmith's Belgians all weigh more than 2,000 pounds and are all between 17 and 19 hands. Hands is how the height of a horse is measured. Hammersmith has been coming to the horse show for the past few years and looks forward to coming each year.
A lot of the hitches, competitive hitches, show up here. It's a nice place to show. It's the people are friendly, and they pay us money to do it. So.
Hammersmith's horses competed in 8 classes throughout the afternoon, including the Unicorn Hitch, 6 Horse Hitch, and the Gelding Team Class. Horse show organizer Ruth Ann McGrew says many of those who participate here compete for more than a placing at the Bushnell Show.
These guys are here to compete for what's known as the North American Classic 6 Series shows. So they're here to be here for the points. And these are very good competitors and nice quality.
Competitors came from places as close as Prairie City and as far away as Ohio. Hundreds of people filled the stands and sat in lawn chairs and on blankets around the show ring. This year's show marked the 100th anniversary of the first horse show held in Bushnell. The show was discontinued during the Great Depression in the 1930s. It was started back up 5 years ago as part of the town's sesquicentennial celebration. I'm Julie Root.
It's summer, and that means that many tattoos that were hidden away for the winter have reappeared, as commentator Amy Gatta explains in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News. It's an open question whether those tattoos have meaning in a legal sense.
There's this show on cable TV that follows tattoo artists in their daily lives, which means that viewers get to see a lot of tattooing. And there's a question these tattoo artists frequently ask their customers. What does your tattoo mean to you? The answer is often poignant. The tattoo is in memory of a relative who died, or a symbol of some obstacle overcome. The non-poignant ones include scary skulls and pretty koi fish, but hey, it's all about individual expression, right? A tattoo, then, could absolutely be seen as a form of speech. And if you conjure up the Constitution, originally graced with elaborate "We the People" cursive that would make many a tattoo artist blue-green with envy, you'll recall that the First Amendment promises that type of freedom. Knowing that, you might wonder how it is that there are restrictions against tattoos and tattooing. Illinois, for one, has a fairly new statute that makes it a crime for any tattoo artist to tattoo a minor, even if that minor has a parent's permission and wants something more tasteful than individual letters of a swear word forever imprinted on the knuckles. The statute makes it a Class A misdemeanor for anyone to tattoo or even offer to tattoo anyone under the age of 18. Just last month, authorities in Springfield announced that a local man had been charged with violating that statute. If Illinois outlaws all tattoos for minors, even those undertaken with parental permission, might both freedom of speech and freedom of the parents to make appropriate decisions for their children be implicated, and might the law be unconstitutional? The problem is that not all courts agree about the constitutionality inherent in tattooing and tattoos. In 1980, a Minnesota court found no showing that a normal observer or even the recipient would regard the process of injecting dye into a person's skin through the use of needles as communicative expression. 4 years later, an Indiana court wrote that all courts that had decided the issue rejected the notion that tattooing was speech or symbolic speech. That same year, a court in Delaware upheld an anti-tattooing ordinance on those grounds. Ditto in South Carolina in 2002. And a federal trial court in Chicago just this past March differentiated between the tattoo itself and the tattooing process in finding no First Amendment protection for an act that it said is not intended to convey a particularized message. But things could be changing. A Massachusetts court reiterated in 2007 its earlier holding that tattooing is First Amendment protected expression. 10 years before, a federal appeals court seemed to say that at least some tattoos deserve constitutional protection. And since some courts have relied at least partly on the notion that tattoos mean nothing, those tattoo TV shows that highlight tattoos with meaning and poignant discussions between tattooer and tattooee during the tattooing process could swing some judges around. If you go to one Chicago tattoo shop's website and click on the Happy Customers link, you'll see a photo of a young man obligingly holding his head up to reveal the word "goon" in giant capital letters emblazoned on his neck. There's also a picture of a devilish-looking man whose entire face appears to be blue-green from tattoos. But as much as the viewer might like to hear their answers to the "what does your tattoo mean to you" question, they're not likely to allow that sort of speech on TV. But that's another legal issue entirely. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and sky.
The world's energy demand is growing. Experts say it may double by the year 2050.
Well, that's really hard for Easy Oil to keep up with. By Easy Oil, I mean oil that's easy to reach and easy to recover.